Up, Up, and Away, Episode 37, Superman, Champion of the Oppressed. Hello and welcome to Up, Up, and Away, the podcast dedicated to anything and everything Superman. I am your host, Mario Benessi. You know, I've been doing this show for close to 40 episodes, a little over 2 years, and the hardest part about this show, it's not the editing, it's not the comic or episode coverage, it's not finding a fact or a quote or a song for every episode. The hardest part about this show is opening it. I have no clue what to say as soon as I finish the tagline for the show. I really don't. It's the hardest part, and sometimes I just end up winging it, and it's always been kind of difficult. See, I found that having a co-host makes things a little bit easier. Over on my other show, Collector's Coalition, with my buddy, it's a lot easier because I have somebody to really bounce personalities off of. So we get to joke a little bit, and we get to talk about how each other is doing and stuff. It's easier having a co-host than hosting a show by yourself, for the most part. I don't know, it's just one of those things that I've noticed, and so, you know, just a little insight into the podcasting world, or at least from my perspective. I don't know if it's the same for everybody else. It's kind of weird just starting with a tagline and then jumping right into a discussion about Superman or whatever the podcast happens to be talking about. It's kind of interesting. You ever have one of those weeks where everything just kind of decides to happen at once, where everything that you're involved with just kind of seems to gang up on you? I had one of those weeks this week. Now, I'm doing all right. I'm doing as well as any college student can be at this point. Well, as far as a student could be, being thousands of dollars in debt and majoring in film, which means essentially getting a degree in unemployment. But this week was pretty rough. See, all my classes wanted to have something do. Multiple things do, even. All of them. Not just one. No, all four of them. And all my courses are very writing intensive. Now, writing papers is not a difficult thing for me. I've been writing papers for a very long time, and if grades are an indication of quality, then I'm pretty good at them. I received nothing less than a B+ on any of the papers that I've submitted over the past 7 years. So it's safe to say that I know what I'm doing. But there comes a point when you get done with it. You're really done with it. And I've kind of reached that point for some of my classes. I had not one, but three papers due this week. The bright side is that one of the papers that I got to write was actually about Superman. It's for a class that's called Advanced Exposition, and so we explain something to a reader that might not entirely be familiar with a subject or a concept, and we explain what it is, and for this paper, we're pretty much writing about the discussions and the conversations that are being had about said subject. So for mine, I chose to write about whether Superman is still popular and, you know, people's differing viewpoints on it. It's something that I actually care about. Now, the two other papers that were due this week, one of them was due on Tuesday, another one due on Thursday. The first one, we got to write an analytical paper on any of the films that we had seen in my Italian-American cinema class. Now, by all logic, I should like this class. I'm Italian. I'm American. I love cinema. I hate this course. It is the biggest waste of a class that I have ever had to experience since my script writing class. I have learned nothing new, and I probably won't learn anything new because this is one of those classes where it just combines two majors into one class, and it's very basic. And week after week, I have to listen to lectures about all these things that I'm already familiar with, and I come away with nothing new. The only thing new that I really come away with is the, more often than not, terrible film. Now, we started the class pretty strong, watching films by Scorsese like Mean Streets and Who's That Knocking at My Door and Goodfellas, and then Francis Ford Coppola's masterpiece, The Godfather. And then we started moving into the films that didn't necessarily portray Italian-Americans as being part of the mafia. Now, that's all fine and good. You know, Italians aren't all criminals and gangsters. That's just one aspect. Now, there are such things as Italian mafias. That's a real thing. A lot of Italians are in some way, shape, or form connected to the mafia. The films that my professor has chosen are horrible. Absolutely dreadful films. Terrible writing, terrible acting, terrible camera work. Just absolutely horrendous. And, see, writing a paper about something that you don't care about is relatively easy. As long as you get the gist of what the professor wants, you can write a paper about it and get a good grade. Assuming that you know how to write a paper, you can get a good grade on these things. But the hardest thing I find for writing for this course is writing about the artistic intentions of the author, or the director rather, where there clearly are none. Where everything just happens to be able to be interpreted. It's hard. It's really hard. The paper that I had to write for Thursday, fortunately it was only a one-page paper, but it was still one of the most challenging papers that I had to write this week, was about this film that essentially was a made-for-TV movie that was absolutely devoid of anything really creative. There were maybe like one or two instances of minor creativity, and even then, they were poorly done. Now, the film wanted to say a lot of things. Many things about Italian culture and finding your roots, knowing who you are, the gender roles in Italian society. I wanted to say all of these things, but in the very end, it said very little, and it said it very poorly. It was not a good film. And to have to pull an essay out of thin air was incredibly difficult. I managed to survive, though, so I'm alright. It was just a really hectic week. Three papers and a midterm and a quiz. Not the best way to spend my week. But, hey, it's the weekend now, so, you know, I can relax a little bit. You ever have one of those decisions that you make and you're not exactly sure why you did it, but you kind of know why? Yeah, I'm going through that right now. You see, I have two copies of Superman 4 on DVD. The first one is the individual release, that was the deluxe edition. The second being from the tin pack, the one that came in the metal box, from right around the time that Superman Returns was put out on DVD, and they put all the Christopher Reeve films and the Donner cut of Superman 2 and the Superman documentary and all the bonus discs for all the Superman films. They put it all in one big complete package. Well, I don't know what happened, and I can't even remember which copy of Superman 4 that I have, but when I went to college for this semester, well, really last year, I just moved from one building to another, I put all my Superman discs in a disc book. That way I wouldn't have to carry around a million different DVD cases. Just makes things a whole lot easier. It's all in one book. It's just flip through it. For some reason, the copy of Superman 4 that I have on me does not play. Now, I tried it on my DVD player, and I tried it on my Blu-ray player. It would not work. And that kind of bummed me out, because I was listening to some older episodes of Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, and during the year of Superman's 75th anniversary, he had done a audio commentary for Superman 4, and I wanted to, you know, watch and listen along. I had listened to his commentaries for Superman 1 and Superman 2, and I figured, well, since there's not really one for Superman 3, I'll just watch Superman 4. So that kind of disappointed me. And for a long time, I couldn't find a copy of Superman 4, and I was, you know, I was not entirely on board for buying another copy of Superman 4 on DVD, so I just kind of put it off. And then I found out that Walmart had exclusive versions of the Superman films, the Christopher Reeve ones. They were individually packaged, and for some reason, they had Superman 1 and 2 on DVD and 3 and 4 on Blu-ray. I wasn't sure, because I had seen the box art for these individual releases on the internet in several places, but I wasn't sure if they were real versions of the film. I thought that maybe they were just fan edits or pictures used by, I think Amazon had them on their website where you could just watch the movies online. You just stream it. I wasn't sure if these were licensed, authorized copies from DC and Warner Brothers, or if they were just fan-made covers. I've seen this happen a couple of times. And then I looked on Walmart.com. They were real. And they had Superman 3 and Superman 4 up for purchase. Now, my copy of Superman 3 works just fine. And I probably will get around to getting 3 on Blu-ray. Just because I like having my movies on Blu-ray now. There's an increased amount of special features. I like the enhanced video quality, the enhanced audio quality. There's just something cool about Blu-ray, and that's, you know, that's speaking to me as being a film buff. So I went ahead and bought a Blu-ray copy of Superman 4. Yeah. So I popped it in the other day, and while the picture quality is phenomenal, even superior to the film quality of the Blu-ray release of Superman the movie, the film is still terrible. In fact, it's worse than I remember. And the fact that it's on Blu-ray and it's in 1080p quality, the issues with the special effects are glaringly bad. The blue screen is horrendous. Now, the only reason, and it's, I still give this reason every time somebody asks me why I have a copy of it, well, now 3 copies of it, the only reason I watch that film is for Christopher Reeve. Because no matter how bad the scripts got, no matter how campy they were, Chris always grounded the Superman character, and he made the character believable. Additions to my collection were pretty light this week. I have a couple of items that are making their way towards me in the mail, but they're not going to be here for a while. Actually, no, one of the items that I had ordered, it's the second volume of the Superman Silver Age dailies. I think it's 1961 to 1963 or 64. That just got delivered. I'm just waiting for my university mailing service department to process the package and then send me an email notification so I can go and pick that up. I'm so happy that I was able to find a copy that I could actually afford, because these books can get pretty pricey. I mean, The cover price for these books, or the retail price really, is $50. 50 big ones. That's pretty pricey. So I try to find them whenever they're $20 or cheaper. And sometimes I can find them, sometimes I win them in auctions. I just like having these almost forgotten pieces of Superman history on my shelf. The other item that I have waiting for me, and it's something that I won in an auction, if I'm not mistaken, I know what it is. It's from the Superman Man of Steel toy line that was put out by Kenner in the late 90s. It's a Superman doll. It's got the little Superman stand and everything, and it's got the long hair and the actual cloth suit and cape. I'm excited to get that. Now, I'm not sure if somebody had opened the History of Superman 3-pack set, or if this was the one that was put out, the Kmart exclusive one that they had put out. I'm thinking it might be the Kmart exclusive one. And if that's the case, that's cool. I mean, there's not really that much of a difference between the Kmart exclusive one and the one from the History of Superman box set. In fact, I think there's no difference at all. I think it's just individual packaging that's really the difference on that. But I got that coming in the mail. I don't think the seller has shipped the item yet, but I'm looking forward to having that on my shelf. It's at least 11 or 12 inches. It looks brand new, came from a collector. It's out of the package, which is fine. I can get one that's in the package and then have one to display and one to have in the package. I'm that kind of guy. See, the great thing about being a collector is that getting duplicates is actually kind of a blessing. I mean, space-wise, it's kind of a curse, but it's a blessing because you have one to open and you have one to keep in package. And I like that. Because I like taking my items out of the package sometimes, if I have a duplicate, and only if I have a duplicate. All my multiverse figures, all of my standard BVS action figures, the 6-inch ones, Those are all mint in their package, unless I had a duplicate. I take my pops out of the box. I take my Dorbs out of the box. But there are some items that you just don't take out of the box. And I don't even do it really for the potential increase in value. I do it because I like seeing the evolution of packaging designs. And I did it way before I was really seriously collecting Superman. When I was collecting Star Wars hardcore, and I still collect Star Wars, my life is strung together by a series of what is Mario collecting at this point in his life. When I was collecting Star Wars, I would keep a lot of my figures in the package. In fact, I still have a lot of figures in the package. I have one of those giant Tupperware containers. I don't know if it's called Tupperware, really, but one of those giant plastic bins just with unopened Star Wars figures. Now, I had to make some room in my closet a couple years ago, and I ended up selling a couple of them. Some of the ones that, you know, really weren't worth that much. I got like $50 for, I think, maybe 10 of them or something like that, which is fine. I was just trying to make a little extra money on the side. But I still have a lot of the ones that actually have gone up in value. But for the Superman stuff, I usually keep a lot of the stuff in the package just because I like the way the packaging looks. You know, you get some really cool... The designs of the package is awesome. I like that kind of stuff. I don't know. I love being a collector. So I'm going to take a really quick break. I'm going to play a promo for an event that I'm going to be doing next month that I'm pretty excited about. I actually composed the music for this advertisement way back when I was in high school. I was planning on doing a short film based on the, you'll see. I'll talk more about it in a future episode. But when we come back, we will take a look at Action Comics number 1 and then continue from there. So don't go away. Black night is
falling. After 54 years, DC Comics has decided to kill off Superman.
November 18th. 1992.
Man of Steel has proven to be as vulnerable as the mere mortals who've looked up to him for more than half a century.
It was a day many thought would never come.
Can it be true? Superman will die November 18th at the hands of a villain named Doomsday?
The day that the unthinkable happened.
Superman meets his demise at the hands of supervillain Doomsday in the 75th edition of the popular DC comic.
Hello, my name is Mario Benessi, and I host the Up, Up, and Away podcast. For as long as I've been a Superman fan, I've been fascinated by the Death of Superman story.
After 50-some-odd years, to get people to notice, sometimes you have to go to extremes.
During the month of November, episodes of the Up, Up, and Away podcast will be dedicated to the comic event that shook the nation and left millions wondering if the Man of Steel was gone for good.
No, they're not going to kill Superman.
I think they do it just to get money, and then, like, he's going to revive in 2 days.
There's too much money tied up in Superman fans to say that forever. And nobody knows what his Kryptonian physiology is like.
You can find the show on Podomatic at upupandaway.podomatic.com and through iTunes. The show and other Superman-related goodies can be found on Facebook by searching Up, Up, and Away Podcast. Mario can be contacted through Twitter at MarioFanOfSteel and through email at mbenessi94@yahoo.com. That's B as in boy, E-N-N-E-S-E. Up, Up, and Away is a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network. Is it considered weird to play an ad for your own show and your own podcast? I don't know. Anyway, yes, during the month of November, I'm going to be talking about the death of Superman. It's a story that it's very important to me. It's always been one of my favorites. So I'm going to go more in depth on that when November actually rolls around. But I wanted to give you guys a little bit of a heads up. I don't remember if I really gave much of a heads up about Bizarro Month for September, but... I really want to let you guys know about this one because this is a big story. It's one big story arc. I'm just covering the death. That's all I'm doing. But I wanted to give you guys a heads up. So without further ado, let's jump into Action Comics number 1. This is cover dated June 1938. It's the very first appearance of Superman. And I was thinking to myself, you know, you can't really run a Superman podcast without discussing in some way, shape, or form Action Comics number 1. This is an incredibly significant comic. Not only did it introduce the world to Superman, but it also kickstarted the superhero genre. And well, it started the Action Comics line, and we're coming pretty close to reaching 1,000 issues of that. So within the next couple of years, we're going to be at the 1,000th issue of Action Comics. That's phenomenal. But like I said, this is cover dated June 1938. There's no real title for the story. There was a title given to the story in a lot of the earlier Golden Age stories. And the title that they happen to have given this story is Superman, Champion of the Oppressed. Now, of course, the art is by Joe Shuster, and the story is written by Jerry Siegel, and it's pieced together from a lot of the newspaper strips. Because when they were first pitching around the Superman idea to a bunch of various publishers, they sold it as a newspaper strip. And, well, when it got picked up to be a comic book thing, they actually had to take the strips and rearrange them into a comic book format. So that's why a lot of the story is missing, or at least the stuff leading up to the pardoning of Evelyn Curry. That's all included in Superman number one, and I'm not sure if the entirety of the story is reprinted, but in both the omnibus that I'm reading it from, reading this from the Golden Age omnibus, it's also the same way in my copy of the Superman Chronicles Volume 1, where the book just reprints everything leading up to that first bombastic scene in Action Comics number 1. But anyway, let's jump right in. Now, I've already covered the origin story in the second episode of my podcast on the origins of Superman, 1938 through, I think, 1943 is where I stopped on that. It's just a one-page explanation, very, very basic, planets not named. Baby is sent away from the planet in a rocket. He's found by a passing motorist and taken to an orphanage, and he's got super strength. When he reaches maturity, he finds that he can leap an eighth of a mile, raise tremendous weights, and run faster than an express train, and that nothing less than a bursting shell could pierce his skin. And so he decides, from that moment on, to become Superman, champion of the oppressed. And so we start the story off with Superman carrying a woman with her arms tied behind her back, and a rag over her mouth, and he's flying through the air, or rather leaping. He couldn't fly at this point. And he drops her off at the governor's estate, and he rushes up to the building, and he is confronted by the butler. Superman demands that he speaks to the governor immediately. It's a matter of life and death, and the butler's not having any of it. He says, what do you mean by knocking this hour of the night? He tells Superman to get lost, and Superman just smashes through the door. He's not fooling around on this. The butler says that he'll have Superman arrested. Superman demands to be taken to the governor, and the butler, of course, refuses, and Superman just lifts him up, one hand, rushes up the stairs. Now they come to the steel door, and that's the door to the governor's room. The butler decides to get pretty fresh with Superman and says, all right, well, you know, I'll see you bust through this one. Superman tears the door off its hinges. It's bent out of shape pretty good. And he says, hey, it was your idea. And the butler's just shocked. He's dumbfounded. Now, the governor wakes up, and Superman's got a note. Evelyn Curry is to be electrocuted in 15 minutes for murder, but he has proof of her innocence, and he's got a signed confession from the woman that he's left on the lawn of the governor's estate. Now, the butler is just simply doing his job at this point, and he pulls a gun on Superman. Of course, we know that it's not going to work out very well. And a bullet is fired. And, well, nothing happens to Superman. He wrestles the gun away from the butler. And just in time, the governor calls and has Evelyn Curry pardoned before she is electrocuted. Now, the next day, word of the pardoning has, well, been spread throughout the newspapers. And Clark Kent is relieved to find that there is no mention of Superman being involved. Now, at the Daily Star, Clark Kent goes in to see his editor, and his editor, who is unnamed at this point, tells him that he wants Clark to take on the Superman beat. He wants him to find out as much as he can and write a couple stories about him, maybe get an interview. Now, as Clark leaves the office, he gets a tip that there is a man beating his wife over at 211 Court Avenue. So Clark rushes off. Now, as he arrives, he shows up as Superman, and he stops the wife beater from further assaulting his wife. The man tries to also get fresh with Superman, and he pulls a knife on him. Of course, the knife breaks upon hitting Superman's skin, and the man faints. Superman changes back into Clark Kent right as a police officer shows up, and the police officer asks Clark what he's doing there, and Clark says, well, I just happened to have shown up. It looks like Superman might have had a little bit of a role to play here. And back at the Daily Star, Clark asks Lois out on a date, and reluctantly she agrees. Later that night, they're at a club of some sort, and Clark asks Lois why she seems to hate him, why she always avoids him. Lois doesn't really want to give him an answer. She's been writing sob stories all day. Now, over at a table in the bar, there's a group of men, and one of them wants to cut in on the action. One of the men's names is Butch Mattson, and he comes up and he demands that he dance with Lois. Now, Clark being Clark, he has to be meek and mild at this point. He can't show that he's really a Superman. He can't have any kind of a backbone as Clark Kent. Now, Lois refuses to dance with Butch. Clark doesn't stand up for Lois, and Lois decides that, no, none of you are getting dances. I'm leaving right now. And before she leaves, she smacks Butch on the face, and Butch gets a little bit physical with Clark. He pushes his face a little bit. He's kind of a jerk. Now, Clark runs after Lois, and she has hailed a taxi, and she's getting ready to go back home. Lois finally gives him an answer as to why she usually avoids him. She says it's because he's a spineless, unbearable coward. Now, Butch and his buddies, they're kind of entitled jerks. So they leave, and he's determined to find Lois Lane, and I don't know what his intentions really are. We just know that they're not very good. Now, a few minutes later, we see his car driving off, and Superman is high above, overlooking the road. Butch's car forces Lois's taxi into a ditch, and they kidnap Lois. They force her into the car, but fortunately for her, Superman lands right in the middle of the road. Now, Butch and his buddies think that they can outwit Superman, and they think that they can just run him over. Superman's not gonna budge. Superman jumps over the car and then starts chasing them, and these guys are freaking out. They've never seen anybody do this. And then with one hand, Superman lifts the car up, shakes all of the passengers out, catches Lois in one of his free hands, and then proceeds to smash the car. And this is a different rendition of the picture that's on the cover. Superman chases Butch down, and he hangs him up onto an electrical pole. And he tells Lois, "Don't be afraid, I'm not going to harm you." And then he takes Lois in his arms and brings her back home, and he tells her before leaving, "I advise you not to write any stories about this." Now, the next morning in the editor's office at the Daily Star, Lois tries to tell her editor-in-chief that she encountered Superman last night, and the editor doesn't really believe her. At this point, Superman isn't really a well-known figure. He's more of a myth. Clark attempts to apologize to Lois for what happened last night, and she gives him the cold shoulder. Later on, Clark receives an assignment from his editor, and his editor says, "Kent, the front page is getting so dull, I've even got to headline card games. There's a war going on in a small South American republic, San Monte, and to stir up news, I'm sending you down there as correspondent. Take along a camera and try to send back some good shots with your articles." And so Clark takes a train, not to San Monte, but to Washington, D.C. Now, in the capital city, he attends a session of Congress, and he's sitting in the gallery, where he spots Senator Barrows. After the session, Clark spots Senator Barrows with a rather shady-looking fellow, and he overhears a conversation. One of the men says, "When can I see you?" Senator Barrows says, "I told you never to speak to me in public. My home, tonight, at 8:30. Clark goes to a local newspaper office with a picture that he happened to have snapped of the two, and he asks a couple questions. "Hey, who's this guy?" And he finds out that it's Alex Greer, and he is one of the slickest lobbyists in Washington, D.C. So, at 8:30 p.m., outside of Senator Barrow's residence, Superman just kind of listens in. He eavesdrops from the outside of the building, not from within the hallway, from the outside of the building. Now, Senator Barrows and Greer are having a discussion. "I've told you to avoid me in public. What would people think if they knew that I had anything to do with you?" Barrows asks. "Quit sputtering. I had to see you. Tell me, do you think you'll succeed in pushing the bill through?" "There's no doubt about it. The bill will be passed before its full implications are realized. Before any remedial steps can be taken, our country will be embroiled with Europe. Fine, we'll take care of you financially for this. I suppose you're going to be well taken care of yourself? And Superman says, oh, you bet he will. Now, upon leaving Barrows, Greer is confronted by Superman. Now, Superman asks him, who is behind you in corrupting Senator Barrows? Now, Greer is playing hardball. He doesn't want to talk. Superman's got ways of making people talk. So he grabs Greer by the foot, and he leaps out the window, and he starts running along telephone wires. Now, Greer is freaking out. Greer says, stop, stop, we'll be electrocuted. Superman says, no, we won't. Birds sit on telephone wires, and they aren't electrocuted. Not unless they touch a telephone pole and are grounded. Now, at this point, he starts playing around with Greer a little bit. And he, quote-unquote, almost touches a telephone pole. Now, they come up to the Capitol, and Superman says, hey, let's pay them a visit. And Greer insists that Superman take him down. Superman says, hey, let's see if we can jump all the way to that building. Now, Greer is terrified. He's frightened out of his mind at this point. And despite Greer's frenzied protests, Superman leaps out into the night. And it looks like they missed. To be continued. And the story continues in Action Comics number 2. But I feel like a lot of the story is in Action Comics number 1. The rest of the story just kind of goes into the whole San Monte thing. And it follows on with that. And it's a good story, but I really wanted to talk about Action Comics number 1. I feel that you can't really host a Superman podcast without touching on this issue. It's a landmark issue. It's incredibly significant. Not just for the character, but for the comic book industry in general. The art is rather rough around the edges. But it's got this charm to it that only Joe Shuster could really bring to, well, the comic book. I feel that any other artist on this book, it wouldn't have been as impactful as it is. And it wouldn't have taken off like it did. There's something kind of adventurous and wild, but still kind of a little refined. There's something about that to the art that really lends itself well to these early adventures of Superman. There are a lot of panels in here that are phenomenal and that are iconic. A couple of my favorites are the panels where Superman tears down that steel door in the governor's mansion, the panel where Superman throws the wife beater up against the wall, of course the panel where Superman smashes Butch's sedan, the panel, and this has been redrawn by Alex Ross, the panel where Superman and Lois Lane meet each other for the first time and he says, you needn't be afraid of me, I won't harm you. This book is just, well, it's incredible. And it's a really interesting introductory issue for Superman. I mean, we get less than a page, we get 3/4 of a page of backstory for the character, and then we jump right into an adventure. And he does so many different things in this book. I mean, he saves a person from being wrongfully executed. He stops a wife beater. He saves Lois Lane from some rather handsy ruffians. He looks into some political corruption. That's awesome. All in the first issue. All in 13 pages. And this issue has been reprinted numerous times. It's in a lot of books. Chances are if you have a Best of Superman volume, you probably got it. I know it's in the Superman in the 40s, even though this was released in 1938, they just put it in that volume. It's in Superman from the 30s to the 70s, Superman from the 30s to the 80s, Superman Chronicles Volume 1, Superman Archives Volume 1, or Action Comics Archives Volume 1, something like that. The Superman Golden Age Omnibus Volume 1, The Greatest Superman Stories Ever Told Volume 1. It's everywhere. Additionally, it's had numerous reprints. They had the 50th anniversary reprint for Superman. They had a version from, I think, 1991 or 1992. They had the giant-sized DC Deluxe Edition or something like that, the DC Special. I'm pretty sure they did a copy of it in the DC Millennium Edition series that they had, about 2000 or something like that. It's been reprinted many times. Without this comic, comic books wouldn't be the way that they are today. So let's jump on over to The Adventures of Superman. Now, just in time for Halloween, or rather a week before Halloween, we have The Evil Three. It's a very, very famous episode of this show. This synopsis is written by James Lance over at the Superman homepage, and like I say every episode, if you have not read his material, go and read it. You are doing yourself a great disservice by not reading it. He's got some wonderful insight into the episode and a very in-depth look at it. But the original broadcast date for this episode is January 23rd, 1953. It's written by Ben Peter Freeman and directed by Tommy Carr, and it stars George Reeves as Superman / Clark Kent, John Hamilton as Perry White, Jack Larson as Jimmy Olsen, Jonathan Hale as Colonel Brand, Reese Williams as Macy Taylor, and Cecil Elliott as Elsa. Daily Planet editor Perry White and Cub reporter Jimmy Olsen are on a rather unsuccessful fishing trip together. All they seem to be getting is bitten by mosquitoes. Perry wants to stay the night at the Hotel Bayou, where he can catch bass from the property's stream. Meanwhile, in the establishment in question that evening, Colonel Brand has his sword poised to attack Macy Taylor. The two men fight as Elsa, an elderly woman confined to a wheelchair, watches from the top of the second-floor stairs. She is laughing maniacally while the two trade punches and break objects. Perry and Jimmy may be walking into trouble on their vacation. The Hotel Bayou is in a sorry state when Jimmy and Perry arrive. Debris from the brawl between Macy and Brand is all over the place. Perry remembers staying there 7 years ago when Macy's uncle George Taylor owned it. Macy claimed that George had drowned and tries to dissuade the pair from staying the night. Perry goes out to his car, leaving Jimmy to sign the hotel's register. The editor is suspicious of Macy Taylor. He seems to recall that George had disappeared. To confirm this, Perry calls Clark Kent from his automobile's radio telephone. The mild-mannered reporter is ordered to discover what he can about the elder Taylor's death and contact the chief in an hour. In the meantime, Macy is telling Jimmy that the Hotel Bayou hasn't had any guests since Uncle George's ghost was first seen walking through the halls. Perry and Jimmy may regret spending the evening there. In spite of Jimmy's fears, Perry still insists that they stay in the Hotel Bayou. He senses that there is a story for the Daily Planet there. Perry seems to remember that the eccentric George Taylor did not trust banks. The editor also believes that Macy has lied about many things to scare him and Jimmy away. Macy had said that the hotel's stream had no fish, but Perry and Jimmy saw some bass jumping when they had arrived. Clearly, Macy is hiding something. However, whatever it is may place Jimmy and Perry in grave peril. Jimmy has seen what appears to be the ghost of George Taylor on two occasions. The spectral form even slapped him in the face while he slept. The Cub reporter has also heard the insane laughter of Elsa echoing through the hotel's corridors. Jimmy and Perry are now investigating things further. They discovered a ramp that leads to a subterranean level where a skeleton is chained to a wall. Perry seems to know who was held captive, but before he can reveal this to Jimmy, Macy and Colonel Brand attack him and young Olsen. Brand is disposing of Perry's car while Macy prepares to kill his new prisoners. Perry and Jimmy may not be able to leave the Hotel Bayou alive. Clark Kent has not gotten a response to his call to Perry. Worried, he becomes Superman and flies to the Hotel Bayou. Meanwhile, Perry and Jimmy have regained consciousness and managed to get back to the room. It is at this point Elsa reveals herself to them and explains the true motives of Macy Taylor. Macy had killed George Taylor for the money that had been hidden in the cellar for years. The insane Colonel Brand and Elsa knew that the nephew had kept his uncle chained under the hotel and starved him to death. Macy had no choice but to share the wealth with Elsa and Brand while pretending to be George's ghost to fend off hotel guests. Now Elsa wants no more blood on her hands. She wishes to help Perry and Jimmy if they assist her in getting the riches buried in the cellar. She's the only one with the location's information, but she is unable to go there without help. The pair of men agree with the old woman's plan. However, it could mean their doom. Macy Taylor has pushed Elsa's wheelchair down the ramp to the basement, leaving her with Jimmy and Perry hidden behind the same rock where bunches of $100 bills are stashed. It looks like there may be no way out for Superman's friends. Superman has met Colonel Brand, who is leading him away from the Hotel Bayou. Neither Brand nor his sword are a match for the Man of Steel. He returns to the hotel to fight Macy and free Elsa, Perry, and Jimmy. The police have captured the evil three, with the mad Elsa laughing that nobody got the money. Superman offers to fly Jimmy and Perry back to Metropolis, but the chief has had enough excitement for one night. He and Jimmy will take a train home. However, Jimmy wants a rain check on the flight. "Sure thing, Jim. Any time at all," smiles the Man of Tomorrow. I really like this episode. It's very spooky, very creepy. The lighting is awesome. A lot of shadows, a lot of long takes. There's very little cutting in some of the scenes, especially the first scene between Perry and Jimmy where they're talking about fishing and all that jazz. It's all in one continuous take, which is pretty awesome. And it's really a testament to the acting ability of these two actors. Just like in The Haunted Lighthouse, we see a more terrified Jimmy Olsen. And Jack Larson does this very well. Superman looks awesome. George Reeves just really has that Superman presence about him. And I watched this episode two times tonight. I watched it, the standard version, then I watched it with the commentary by... I forgot who did the commentary on the DVD box set, but it was very informative. And what they had said in the commentary is that this was the last episode filmed for season one, which is pretty cool. But George really seems to have this John Sekela style Superman figure to him. It's really noticeable when he shows up at the Hotel Bayou for the first time, and he's got that classic early to mid 40s Superman look about him, and it's awesome. I love it so much. It's a great episode. If you haven't seen it, please check it out. So let's jump over to the Essential Superman Encyclopedia. Arclight. To the mob, an arsonist is a torch. Hence the name Arclight for the creature mafia torch Noah Pastinetti became. Arclight was born when Pastinetti was found to be an investigative reporter's source, and the maid guy's crew trapped him inside a nuclear power plant before blowing it up. Pastinetti survived as a being of destructive energy, however, given form by a containment suit in which he literally burned for revenge. His hot-headedness extended to reporters as well, and Clark Kent's Daily Planet colleagues found themselves threatened by Arclight while attending a journalist's convention in Washington, D.C., where Superman reteamed with Agent Liberty to save his friends. This is in Superman Volume 2, Number 99. April 1995. After murdering reporter Alicia Parker in Washington and attempting to steal the contents of her strongbox, Arclight overexerted his power and merged his energy into Superman's body. Once the energy of Arclight's essence had been drained off, he was placed into a new containment shell and taken into custody. That's in Superman Volume 2, Number 103, August 1995, and Superman The Man of Tomorrow, Number 2, Fall 1995. Ardora. Lex Luthor's one known lover and later wife in the pre-Crisis universe as Ardora, a native of a distant and arid planet that would rename itself Lexor in Luthor's honor. It was originally visited by Superman and Luthor as the site of a boxing match to which Luthor had challenged the Man of Steel, chosen because of its red sun, under which Superman would have no superpowers and would presumably be Luthor's physical equal. When Superman discovered the desert-like world's primitive humanoid civilization, he learned that its denizens knew nothing of irrigation. He quickly corrected that problem, but through a complex series of misunderstandings, the natives attributed the miracle of lush greenery that bloomed in their midst to Luthor's scientific genius rather than Superman's super-speedy canal building. Thus, Lexor became the planet that revered Luthor as a great hero, and he saw to it that they mistakenly believed Superman to be their worst enemy. In time, Luthor found ways of returning to Lexor to indulge what capacity for humanitarianism he possessed, eventually transforming the planet into a high-tech utopia. And with each visit, his gentler side continued to be nurtured by Ardora's enduring love until at last they married. Luthor returned to Lexor one last time, discovering that Ardora had given birth to his son, Alexander Luthor Jr. As usual, Lex performed acts of heroics, notably erecting a neutral rod that would stabilize the internal stress at Lexor's core that threatened to blow it up. Meanwhile, Lex made use of technology he'd discovered in an ancient lab to build a battle suit for the inevitable day that Superman came for him. When that conflict took place, though, one of Luthor's power blasts ricocheted off the Man of Steel's chest, striking the neutral rod and starting a chain reaction. Desperately flying toward Ardora and his son, Lex had nearly reached them when the planet exploded. On the parallel world of Earth 154, Lex and Ardora had a teenage daughter, also named Ardora, who once encountered the super sons of Superman and Batman. That's in World's Finest Comics, number 238, June 1976. She was glimpsed briefly on New Earth, and that's in Infinite Crisis, number 6, June 2006. Argo City. The birthplace of the pre-Crisis Supergirl, Kara Zor-El, who was born after Krypton exploded. Argo City survived the destruction because the fragment of the planet on which it was built was hurled into deep space by the force of the explosion. Its citizens survived with buildings and economic system intact because the city was enclosed in a synthetic biodome built to accommodate meteorological research being conducted by Zor-El, Argo's preeminent scientist, and the man who would later father Kara. That's in Action Comics number 252, May 1959, and Superman volume 1, number 150, January 1962, as well as Action Comics number 316, September 1964, and many others. The floating city was able to drift through space in this fashion for almost 15 Earth years. For most of that time, life for the Argoans settled back into a kind of normalcy until they discovered what Superman on Earth was also learning. The chain reaction that had destroyed Krypton had left its fragments radioactive. This meant that Argo City now sat atop a giant mass of the lethal green mineral Superman would call kryptonite. The radiation beneath their feet began to sicken and kill the citizens of Argo until Zor-El blocked it by sealing off the ground with lead shielding. Other accounts, however, have stated that the radioactive mineral was actually something called anti-kryptonite. Regular green kryptonite could only affect superpowered Kryptonians. In any event, life in Argo City went on. But the year Kara turned 15, a meteor shower punctured both Argo's dome and the lead-covered surface, releasing deadly radiation that ostensibly killed off Argo's population. But not before Zor-El and his wife Allura had placed Kara in a small spacecraft and launched her toward Earth. The kryptonite poison Argo City was later visited by the evil Vrangs. That's in Action Comics number 548, October 1983, and ultimately caused to collide with Metropolis by Mr. Mixture Spitalik. That's in DC Comics Presents number 97, September 1986. In the history that emerged after Infinite Crisis, Argo City was once again the home of Zor-El and family. Prior to Brainiac's destruction of Krypton, Allura used the evil alien's shield technology to form a protective dome over the city, allowing them to survive. When Brainiac discovered their use of his tools, he located the floating city and had it added to his already captured city of Kandor. It was then that Zor-El and Allura chose to send their daughter Kara to Earth to find her cousin Kal-El. That's in Action Comics number 869, November 2008. Arion, Lord of Atlantis. This volatile, magically powered, and immortal protector of Atlantis first existed 45,000 years ago, long before the disaster that submerged the so-called Lost Continent. It's in Warlord number 55, March 1982. He was incarnated in three of Superman's realities, the pre-First Crisis Earth 1, that's Arion, Lord of Atlantis, number 1 through 35, November 1982 through September 1985, the post-First Crisis Unified Cosmos, Arion the Immortal, 1 through 6, July 1992 through December 1992, and New Earth. In each instance, he was the offspring of Atlantean gods. He was revered by the Atlantean people for having sacrificed his corporeal form to prevent Atlantis from being destroyed in an act of divine retribution by his vengeful mother and older brother. His mastery of magic allowed him to exist as a wraith for nearly 500,000 years, becoming tangible once more approximately 5,000 years ago. At that point, he became the Lord High Mage of Atlantis, residing in the City of the Golden Gate. The Superman of the pre-First Crisis Earth-1 first encountered Arion when the Atlantean Mage journeyed through time into his future, arriving in then-present-day Metropolis in pursuit of a renegade god named Chaon. The quest led Arion and the Man of Steel back to ancient Atlantis, where they ultimately defeated Chaon. That's in DC Comics Presents number 75, November 1984. Perhaps the most significant interaction between Arion and the Man of Tomorrow was in the New Earth reality. This iteration of Arion, however, seemed more morally ambiguous and less overtly a champion of the oppressed. This became clear when, in the year 1659, Arion had a series of nightmarish visions of an apocalyptic far future wherein the destruction of human society had been in some way caused by Superman. Using an assortment of magical artifacts to generate enough eldritch energy to propel him forward in time, Arion arrived in present-day Metropolis with a warning for Superman. Arion argued that humankind's natural development was being corrupted by the good works of the Man of Steel, and all superheroes for that matter, but Arion appealed to Superman as the most powerful being, or at least the first among equals. Super beings were constantly saving humans from their own tendency towards self-destruction. Arion cautioned, advancing their development to a point that was, in a sense, unnatural. Arrian argued that entropy affects everything, and human civilization itself must inevitably and ineluctably collapse. This, Arrian prophesied, would occur with the emergence of a Middle Eastern warlord named Kyber, who would conquer Earth with the aid of an army of cyborg assassins who would also kill Superman. Kyber's rule, Arrian envisioned, would plunge Earth into a new dark age, human society having been allowed to evolve beyond the point at which it was meant by nature to degenerate, merely had been given by Earth's superheroes farther to fall. Arrian's argument, then, was not unlike the theme sounded by Batman's enemy, eco-terrorist Ra's al Ghul. It is necessary to destroy the Earth in order to save it. Arrian pleaded with Superman and Earth's other superheroes to voluntarily abandon their careers, allowing humankind to fulfill whatever its destiny may be, risking its eventual entropic degeneration but averting the catastrophe of Kyber's reign of terror that Arrian had foreseen. Superman found himself faced with a moral dilemma when he discovered evidence that could have substantiated Arrian's prediction, forcing him to consider the possibility that he and his cohorts might be more a hindrance to humanity than help. Ultimately, however, he decided to maintain the status quo. As a result, Arrian felt forced to attempt neutralizing Earth's heroes himself by using his magic to turn them against one another. Ultimately, with the aid of the supernatural figure, the Phantom Stranger, the Man of Steel was able to break Arrian's magical hold and disarm the Atlantean of the mystical artifacts from which he gained his power, thereby returning Arrian to 1659, seemingly for good. As in Superman numbers 654 through 658, September 2006 through January 2007, numbers 662 through 664, May 2007 through August 2007, numbers 667, November 2007, and Superman annual number 13, January 2008. Now, on to the super fact and the super quote, and then we'll close out this episode. So for the super fact, did you know that Jonathan and Martha Kent's wedding anniversary is traditionally celebrated on October 21st? And for this episode's super quote, in keeping with the theme of Action Comics number 1, is one of my favorite lines from the entire issue. It's where Superman takes on the wife beater. It's not particularly inspiring or anything. It's right where he throws him up against the wall. You're not fighting a woman now. Good night, folks.
Is it a rocket?
A UFO?
A missile?
What's that flying through the sky? Superman, it's Superman. Streak of lightning whizzing by. Superman, it's Superman. Man of Steel 10 times as strong. On his way to right or wrong. Evil to West don't last long with Superman. With his super vision, super hearing, super strength and speed, he can outrun, outthink, outjump, outblink, outfight, outkick, outsmart, outwit
above any 10 men.
Any 10 men?
Well, 20.
20?
100?
1,000? An army, a navy, whole kit and caboodle. He'll land them all.
Yeah!
Right smack on their noodle.
Bullets bounce right off his skin. Superman, it's Superman. Fiery flames don't bother him. Superman, it's Superman. Foe of evil, friend in need. Ever ready to do a good deed. Leader of a great new breed. Superman. Bounce right off his skin. Superman, it's Superman. Fiery flames don't bother him. Superman, it's Superman. Foe of evil, friend in need. Ever ready.
ready to do a good deed. Leader of a great new breed, Superman, Superman.
For more Up, Up, and Away, visit www.upupandaway.podomatic.com. The show and other Superman-related goodies can be found on Facebook by searching Up, Up, and Away Podcast, and Mario can be contacted through email at mbenesi94@yahoo.com. That's B as in boy, E-N-N-E-S-E. Up, Up, and Away is a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, and Superman and all related images are property of DC Comics and Warner Brothers Entertainment. All images and music are property of their respective owners, and no infringement is intended. This is a non-profit fan podcast. Superman was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.